Good evening, you're with Richard and Ezra. It's Treat or Treat or Rock and Roll, and this evening we're going to be talking about the one, the only, Nirvana.
The momentum and excitement at the time was so great because there was just like this new thing happening and no one could quite pinpoint it, but we knew that we were a part of it.
There are some bands that are pretty good every night, and then there are bands that can either be the greatest band in the world or a total train wreck. And Nirvana was kind of one of those bands.
I turned on MTV and there we were. It was like the Beatles, you know? It's like Nirvana mania.
What else should I be?
I'm always in pain too, and that really adds to the anger in our music. It really does. Kind of grateful for it.
I got tired of people trying to put too much meaning into my lyrics. People would take it too literally. They think we were being serious because no one sees the funny side of us. So I decided to be really blunt and bold.
We repel the mainstream. And see, there's one thing you have to remember about Nirvana is Nirvana didn't go to the mainstream. The mainstream came to Nirvana, and that was our big crisis.
Change our style of music. I want to do something different, and I want to have enough guts to do that. And if it alienates people, that's too bad.
Now that's how you kick off a show, my friend.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I mean, we always go through the whole thing of going through, you know, their albums and what awards they won. But Nirvana captured a generation, and they defined that, didn't they?
In just three albums.
Three albums, three members. It's great, isn't it? Kurt Cobain, Dave Grohl, Chris Novoselic.
It's going to be easy, you know? I mean, and that's the beautiful thing about a band that has only three members. They could just make so much noise just with the three of them, and they did.
Yeah.
And it was, I remember just playing this stuff when they first came out. I mean, I was the first kid at my school to wear a Nirvana t-shirt. You know, my mum was like, what the heck are you listening to? It's so angry, it's so noisy, it's so loud. And I'm like, yeah, I love it.
And I must have been 10 when I heard Nevermind. And right. If I was never sure as to what rock and roll was in the early 90s, there were a handful of tracks, but you heard Teen Spirit. It was just ridiculous, and you knew what rock and roll was at that point in time.
Absolute turning point for me in my life. I mean, I've said this before, they came around, and I've been listening to some really horrible stuff that I won't mention, but you know, Nirvana came along and I heard Smells Like Teen Spirit, and I'm just like, this is what I want, this is what I want to be listening to. And you know, I was 16 at the time, 15 16. Absolutely blew me away.
And this evening we'll be covering, you know, some of, you know, their interesting moments when recording their album. Of course, we'll touch a little bit about Kurt Cobain's death. And I don't want to focus too much about one individual member because it's so difficult when you're talking about Nirvana. It's so hard to separate it from Kurt himself. But, you know, what's really interesting is they achieved success in such a short period of time, and they catapulted towards this ridiculous response, not just in Seattle or United States or Europe, but around the world.
Yeah, I mean, by now I think they've sold in the region of 75 million records from three albums, you know, and they were put up for nomination into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame the first year that they were eligible, 2014, and they go in straight away. Some bands have waited years to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Aerosmith, for example, Led Zeppelin, in fact.
Deep Purple are not in there
still
yet.
Still not in there. Yeah. Nirvana straight in.
Yeah. So we want to share with you a clip of, you know, the band finding some success in their early days. This is Chris Novoselic and Dave Grohl speaking to Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show about just having fun with rock and roll and smashing up equipment.
But you just smash everything? You just love to do it? It was fun?
Well, it would make our sets, like, sensational, and then we'd play for 45 minutes, maybe 50 minutes, because Kurt was so intense, you know, and he'd be out there intense and 45, 50 minutes, and we can get off if we smashed everything. But then we played live shows.
That's true. You can't do an encore if everything's
That's
broken.
Right.
Genius!
Genius
idea.
Kind of a shtick. But then we played live shows for like 2 hours.
There's this one, we were on a tour in Chicago, and Kurt had been chopping at my drums all tour, and like my drums had holes in them. Like and they sounded like crap because there were holes in them. They didn't sound good. And I kept asking our tour manager, could I please get a new drum set? And this is before we were playing big places, we were in clubs. He's like, let's wait another week. And I said, and he chopped more holes and wait another week. And so finally I said to Kurt, it's at the Metro in Chicago. I said, hey man, at the end of the gig, we have to smash my drum set to splinters. Because I need a new drum set.
The record industry guy was there. The record label guy was there, so he could buy. He had the credit card.
But the guitars, man, yeah. We spent half an hour breaking those drums. And we told the audience, we said, you can go home. It's all good.
And we're just going to break all this.
Yeah.
The concert's over. So
and then the next day, the drum place was closed. And I was just like,
oh, my God. You're sitting there, yeah, playing the kazoo. Nirvana.
And I always think about that moment where I think it's Kurt Cobain just flying into the drum set. And they had all of these crazy stage antics. Mm. You know, Kurt coming out in a wheelchair. Mm. And, you know, just they were crazy on stage.
They were. I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, they had this iconic rock and roll mindset. And I don't know where that stems from. I mean, they grew up in this, in Aberdeen in Washington State, right? Mm-hmm. It's an area, it's cold, it's depressing, it rains a lot. Kurt's obviously got issues with mental issues and one thing or another. He comes from a broken family. And you just wonder how much of that, I mean, we've done stuff before. We've spoken about Elton John,
yeah.
You know, before, who says, my family and the way that I interacted with them helped to create what I am today. And Kurt was certainly a product of, I think, his environment. You know?
Yeah, and absolutely. And he wasn't the only one. You had other bands like Mudhoney,
right.
And all these bands coming up in the region. And certainly the type of music that they created spoke to so many people. We're going to kick things off with a track from their first album, Bleach. This is School, right here on Cheetah Cheetah Rock and Roll featuring Nirvana, BFM 89.9. It's Cheetah Cheetah Rock and Roll. We're speaking about Nirvana. You're with Richard and Ezra. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to focus on is, you know, when you think about bands, you think about albums. But, you know, when you think about Nirvana, there's one track in particular that screams out at the world. It smells like Teen Spirit. And there is a cliche to it. But when you look at the context of what was happening in rock and roll music at the time, that was a huge track.
it still is.
Yeah.
It's kind of the modern day Stairway to Heaven almost.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, every guitarist that I know will know how to play Smells Like Teen Spirit. It's not a hard track either. And I think that's the beauty of it, is that it's so simple that anybody with a guitar can pick it up and can be playing it in a couple of minutes.
And also, I think at the time, you know, we were not just dealing with cassettes. CDs were coming into play in a big way. MTV was, you know, very influential. And of course, they had an interesting video that really sort of captured all the angst that was happening amongst teenagers and Generation X. And when people saw that video and the drums and the sound and the whole thing was just unbelievable.
I mean, it's a smoke-filled room. You've got these punk guys running around. You've got cheerleaders with tattoos. It's everything that a young, angry young crowd want, you know, and they captured it perfectly in that video.
And Nevermind was not just about that one track. The entire album is great. And I wanted to hear from Butch Vig, the producer of that album, and he speaks about the first time he heard Smells Like Teen Spirit. And after that, we're going to be looking at how he broke down and produced that particular track.
We went to a rehearsal studio in North Hollywood, and the band set up. You know, Chris had his SVT, and Kurt had a Mesa amp, and I think he maybe had a couple of speakers because he wanted it to be, you know, incredibly loud. And Dave set his drums up, and there were no mics on Dave's kit. And I walked in and met everybody, and everybody seemed cool, and was like, well, we might as well play one of the songs. And they got behind the kit, and they played Teen Spirit, started with that little scratchy guitar, and Dave did that, and it just exploded. I remember standing up and pacing around the room. I couldn't believe how intense and how powerful they sounded. And there were no mics on Dave's kit, and the drums were just punishing sounding in the room. I mean, it was pretty amazing sounding. I remember literally breaking out into a sweat going, oh, my God, this is incredible. And I didn't really know what to do when they finished, except I paused and said, that was really good, you guys. Play it again. And I just needed to let my brain digest it. And it was so good and so cathartic sounding. And like a lot of the songs, didn't need a lot of tinkering. As we got into the pre-production over a few days, we made a few changes, tightened up things here and there, shortened things here and there. But they sounded tight. They had been rehearsing, and most of the melodies Kurt had figured out. I still was tinkering with some words in some of the songs, but boy, the first time they played Teen Spirit, it was amazing. In the chorus, we double-tracked. They wanted to make it sound more powerful. I feel stupid and contagious. And he was great at double-tracking. He would just run down a take and do another take, and they always locked up really, really well. Here comes the guitar solo. He basically copped the vocal melody. Instead of trying to come up with something punky or frantic or strangled guitar like he usually did, he just copped the exact vocal melody. And it works really well. And then at the end of the solo, he lets it feed back into the third verse. It's got this great resonant feedback. We actually pulled it back in the final mix, but it would have been cool to leave it in there because it's got great overtones right through here. It starts to bend and morph. Really creepy sounding. His voice down the last chorus. It's starting to get pretty shot. He's been going so hard through the song, pushing so hard. Sounds like his vocal cords are starting to come right out of his throat. Especially when he gets to a denial. It's pretty powerful sounding.
That doesn't give you goosebumps.
Right.
I don't know what will. I mean, when you get a play-by-play by Butch Vig, the producer, like that, it's kind of interesting to see the musical production behind it. I mean, this is just not a couple of kids getting together. They stepped up a level with him behind the decks.
I mean, he's an awesome producer, and over the years, he's had a lot of stick about the kind of level of production he put onto that particular album. People forget, though, he wasn't the guy that gave it the overall mix. You know, he was just the guy that told them this is how we want it to sound and how loud it is. The guy who actually mixed it was Slayer's former mixing engineer.
Is it Brendan Bryan or
Andy
something?
Andy
Wallace.
Yeah, Andy Wallace. Yeah, so Andy Wallace was the final mixer. But there's little tricks and tips within that. There's a real great story how Butch Vig convinces Kurt to do the double tracking on the chorus part. He actually said to him, well, John Lennon double tracked.
Yeah, right. And then Kurt was willing to do so.
Exactly. I mean, that level of kind of having to convince a punk rocker, but just by dropping a hippie name, and it works perfectly.
Absolutely. Of course, ideally we would play Smells Like Teen Spirit, but that would be too predictable. And what we want to play for you, Smells Like Teen Spirit, as covered by Tori Amos. It's a haunting version.
It's a great version.
And Kurt Cobain commented that he actually likes this version. He joked that he and the band would go on stage before the show and sort of do an interpretive dance, and this is Smells Like Teen Spirit. It's covered by Tori Amos by Nirvana. It's Treat to Treat to Rock and Roll right here on BFM 89.9. Good evening, I'm Ezra Zide.
And I'm Richard Bradbury.
It's Treat to Treat to Rock and Roll featuring Nirvana, and of course when we speak about Nirvana, we can't not touch on the death of Kurt Cobain, which led to the end of this particular band.
The Seattle area home of Kurt Cobain, 28-year-old Aberdeen native and lead singer of one of the world's premier grunge rock bands. The body was discovered this morning by an electrician who had arrived at the singer's Lake Washington home.
Though the identity of the victim has not been released, the King County Medical Examiner is working on the presumption. It is that of Kurt Cobain.
Julie, the music world and Washington residents hold their breath at this hour as the medical examiner continues his investigation. Here's a closer look at the Cobain home at 171 Lake Washington. Police are on the scene conducting an investigation. Authorities believe the man inside died after he shot himself in the head with a shotgun. Officials say a suicide note was found near the body.
The electrician was going to do some repair work. He went up to above the garage where there's a small cottage above the garage, and when he looked inside, he saw a man lying on the floor. It was obvious this man is dead from a shotgun wound to the head. Now, there was a suicide note left inside the house, and he quickly left and called the police. Our officers had to break into the door because it was locked. It was obvious this person was dead.
How did you guys find out about this?
We've been hearing it on the radio all day about unconfirmed things. Something happened. They were really
and that was what happened on that day in 1994. Just to place some context, I wanted us to hear from Kurt Cobain himself. And I managed to find an interview in 1993. He's in Seattle. He's had some time off and he's actually in a chirpy mood to actually talk about things like lyrics and his fans and the direction of Nirvana and all these kind of things. This is what he had to say. This is a few months before the suicide happens.
Is it hard when you spend your whole life doing the first few albums and then suddenly everybody needs your attention, you have to do interviews, you have to travel around, and suddenly is it hard to come up with ideas?
I don't know. I've just noticed that people expect more of a thematic angle with our music. You know, they always want to read into it. And before, I was just using pieces of poetry and just garbage, you know, just stuff that just would spew out of me at the time. And a lot of times when I write lyrics, it's just at the last second because I'm really lazy. So, and then I find myself having to come up with explanations for it, you know. So I thought I'd, you know, prevent that this time and actually have an explanation for some of the songs at least.
I'm not sure who in your band said it. It could have been you, could have been someone else. But someone being a little perturbed by them, your mainstream audience, and wanting to just make music for your real fans.
Well, you know, a couple of years ago when we were making these bold negative statements about things like that, you know, we were really confused and we're scared, we're afraid that we would lose a lot of our audience that meant a lot to us because they're people that, you know, we supposedly, hopefully feel that we have a connection with, you know, the college students and people in the underground. No, I don't think we've lost them. I think they're still fans, so I'm not worried about it anymore. And I was at the time.
Is there anything the same between your music and New Wave?
I think so.
Like what?
Well, like, you know, New Wave was just a progression from punk rock and a mutation of punk rock, you know, and it was more commercial and more palatable, you know. It had, you know, punk rock roots and it was easier to swallow for the media and middle America and the middle of the world. And it's just, you know, that's what I kind of think about our music.
Are you worried about a Nirvana backlash?
Hasn't that already been over with? Hasn't that already happened? I don't know. Sure. No. I don't know.
Okay. What does everyone talk to you about?
But we're getting more New Wave as the days go by. I think we're going to reinvent New Wave and bring back breakdancing. I'd really like to bring back New Wave and breakdancing. You know, meld it to something. I don't know. That's what our new music is sounding like. We're using a lot more effects boxes and we haven't resorted to skinny ties, but we're gonna, I think our music's, you know, this album's like the closing of the chapter of the formula we've been using, you know. It's like grunge is, it's really kind of boring for us, you know. It's something we can't deny, and we're not gonna stop playing the old songs live, whoops. And, but, you know, our tastes are just changing so rapidly that we're really experimenting with a lot of stuff, and it might get too indulgent and be really embarrassing for the next album, but we can't put out another album, and this is just like the last chapter of three chord grunge music for us. And it was an easy thing to do and a safe thing to do because we knew it's still popular, you know, but we had to get it out of our systems.
Because you've achieved so much success, I mean, so quickly, so surprisingly, you've had a baby, you're married. What excites you now?
My baby, my marriage. I don't know. I still like playing, too. I mean, Chris and Dave and I haven't changed at all. I mean, believe it or not, we get along just as well as we ever did. You know, we're just as the same passive-aggressive people as we used to be. You know, we never fight. And when we're pissed off at each other, we just hold it under our breath and have respect for one another in that way. You know, it's just, it's easier to work that way, you know, because we have a mission, I guess.
The saddest thing about his suicide, and especially in context of what we heard from that particular excerpt, is the potential of Nirvana. And we heard hints of that, and that will never be realized. But it's such a shame because you hear a man who's just recorded In Utero. He knows where he wants Nirvana to go to next. And he says, you know, we're done with that whole grunge alternative thing. I mean, we want to move on. And
he's right, you know, after kind of In Utero was released, I mean, it sold really, really well. The grunge movement pretty much just disappeared or you know, became something more of a backstory. And just in that little piece there, you know, he's talking to this reporter, but the whole way through, you're hearing the story or the conversation of a man who has a plan for his future, where they're going to go next, what they're going to do next. He's talking about his family, his baby, you know.
His relationship with his fans and how that's changing. And that's why it's so difficult to make sense of his suicide. We're going to play You Know You're Right, which was a song that was finally released in 2002 after some wrangling between Courtney Love, Dave and Chris. But this is it. Treat or Treat to Rock and Roll, Nirvana. You Know You're Right, BFM 89.9. It's Treat or Treat to Rock and Roll, and this evening we've been covering Nirvana. And of course, Rich, you mentioned earlier about being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year.
Yeah, very few bands have done it on their first attempt, so to speak, or the first time that they're eligible, as we mentioned before. A whole bunch of bands who have been around for decades just haven't got in there. Deep Purple, for one example. Nirvana, straight into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
This is Michael Stipe of REM inducting Nirvana into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think you'll love this.
Good evening. I'm Michael Stipe. I'm here to induct Nirvana into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. When an artist offers an idea, a perspective, it helps us all to see who we are. It wakes us up and it pushes us forward towards our collective and individual potential. It makes us, each of us, able to see who we are more clearly. It's progression and progressive movement. It is the future staring us down in the present and saying, come on, let's get on with it. Here we are, now. I'm purposely using the word artist rather than musician because the band Nirvana were artists in every sense of the word. It is the highest calling for an artist as well as the greatest possible privilege to capture a moment, to find the zeitgeist, to expose our struggles, our aspirations, our desires, to embrace and define their time. That is my definition of an artist. Nirvana captured lightning in a bottle. And now I will quote Urban Dictionary off the internet in defining lightning in a bottle as capturing something powerful and elusive and then being able to hold it and show it to the world. Kurt Cobain, Chris Novoselic, and Dave Grohl were Nirvana. The potency and the power of their defining moment has become, for us, indelible. Like my band, REM, Nirvana came from a most unlikely place, not a cultural city center like London, San Francisco, Los Angeles, or even New York, or Brooklyn, but from Aberdeen, Washington, in the Pacific Northwest, a largely blue-collar town just outside of Seattle. Chris Novoselic said, Nirvana came out of the American hardcore scene of the 1980s. This was a true underground. It was punk rock, but the many bands and musical styles were eclectic. We were a product of a community of youth looking for a connection away from the mainstream. Dave Grohl said, We were dropouts, making minimum wage, listening to vinyl, emulating our heroes, Ian MacKaye, Little Richard, getting high, sleeping in vans, never expecting the world to notice. Solo artists almost have it easier than bands. Bands are not easy. You find yourself in a group of people who rub each other the wrong way and exactly the right way, and you have chemistry, zeitgeist, lightning in a bottle, and a collective voice to help pinpoint a moment to understand what it is that we're going through. Nirvana tapped into a voice that was yearning to be heard. Keep in mind the times. This was the late 80s, early 90s. America, the idea of a hopeful, democratic country, had been practically dismantled by Iran-Contra, by AIDS, by the Reagan-Bush senior administrations. But with their music, their attitude, their voice, Nirvana blasted through all that with crystalline nuclear rage and fury. Nirvana were kicking against the system, bringing complete disdain for the music industry and their definition of corporate mainstream America to show a sweet and beautiful but fed up fury coupled with howling vulnerability. Lyrically exposing our frailty, our frustrations, our shortcomings, singing of retreat and acceptance, of our triumphs, of an outsider community with such immense possibility, stymied or ignored, but not held down or held back by the stupidity and political pettiness of the times, they spoke truth and a lot of people listened. They picked up the mantle in that particular battle, but they were singular and loud and melodic and deeply original, and that voice. Kurt, we miss you. I miss you. Nirvana defined a moment, a movement for outsiders, for the fags and the fat girls and the broken toys and the shy nerds and the goth kids from Tennessee and Kentucky, for the rockers and the awkward and the fed up and the too smart kids and the bullied. We were a community, a generation, in Nirvana's case, several generations. And the echo chamber of that collective howl, and Allen Ginsberg would have been very proud here. That moment and that voice reverberated into music and film, into politics, into worldview, and so many fields in so many ways and in our lives. And this is not just pop music. This is something much greater than that.
Well, I'm not Michael's type of REM, and so I have nothing to add to that.
Right. I do have goosebumps, though, and the hairs on the back of my neck are stood up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, and that's the end of Chit Chito Rock and Roll featuring Nirvana. Don't forget, folks, after the 8 o'clock news is BFM Bootlegs Nirvana, a whole bunch of live tracks.
Absolutely.
As well.
Oh, it's going to be loud as well. Do take some time to put aside some time to listen to this. Make sure your parents are sat in the room as well. Turn it up a bit.
And if you miss any part of this program, don't forget to download the podcast at www.bfm.my. Folks, we're going to end the show with Cut Me Some Slack. Now, this is the closest you're going to get to a Nirvana reunion. Pat Smear, Dave Grohl, Chris Novoselic, and another left-handed guitarist, Paul McCartney. This is from the Sound City soundtrack. Cut Me Some Slack, BFM 89.9.